everybody out there, and you know, I have friends, really, really dear friends and trusted friends who to this day are highly skeptical of real estate and say, just invest in the stock market. Real estate grows too slowly. The return on investment's too low. It's only 3.5%. And you try to explain to them, okay, yeah, that house went from 100 to 103.5. But as an investment, if I purchased that house with 20% down, I spent $20,000 and I gained $3,500 on that $20,000, which means I actually got a 17.5% return on investment, because $3,500 in 1 year is 17.5% of $20,000. Well, what if I listen to the Service and Wealth podcast and realize that it's an even smarter idea to qualify for less than 20% down and use like 10% down with a conventional loan and pay the primary mortgage insurance, the PMI. So now I put 10% down. I put $10,000 down on this $100,000 house and it grew $3,500. That's a 35% return on investment in 1 year. Welcome to Service and Wealth, the podcast dedicated to helping military personnel master their finances and achieve financial freedom. Our mission is to guide you through the ins and outs of planning, saving, and investing. And most importantly, how to balance savings so you can enjoy life now and retire with confidence. Hey, we are back once again with the Service and Wealth podcast. I'm the creator, host, producer, content creator, marketer, do everything, Ted Ehlert. And we're back again with another installment of our series of the Service and Wealth podcast focused on real estate for the military. And this is actually, you know, when we started out on this sort of project to do a deep dive into real estate, the concept was for like four, maybe a fifth episode, and this is actually the seventh, and it's probably not even the last one, but it's the last one that is, it makes sense to have scripted out. You know, there's tons of topics. There's entire shows devoted to real estate that have already produced hundreds of episodes, especially from the Bigger Pockets family. So obviously there is more than enough subject matter when it comes to real estate and housing, but in as much as this podcast and our company and our family, our community is focused on improving the financial education and the financial IQ of everyone in uniform and also our veterans who are out of uniform. You know, we can't just solely focus on real estate and talking about real estate investing. So we've got to kind of chop it up. And that's why we decided to do sort of a focus. And the plan had been, of course, to do it over November, December, and then in January with a new year launch into our next focus area. I know there was an episode in which I like promised or announced what that would be. And, you know, that's almost like, you know, it's 10 plus weeks ago whenever I made that statement. So the truth is I don't remember, but that's fine because this is just a process and a journey in which we're going through and we're just talking about finance, we're talking about money, we're talking about military pay and benefits, and really just trying to get the information out there because it affects all of us. And sort of the gouge around the water cooler, which for those who are not like Navy type or Marine types, that means like the rumors that you spread around the office or the barracks. You know, the gouge that's out there is usually wrong. At the very best, it's well-intentioned, but misguided, you know, and when we do get a little bit deeper into talking about retirement, one of the examples that we'll talk about, and it's something that we have already addressed in the blog multiple times, we've talked about a little bit here on the podcast, and we've also pointed it out in our book, Service and Wealth, which you can get either paperback or Kindle from Amazon, is that going all in, maxing out your thrift savings plan is a really, really bad personal financial plan. It's a really bad strategy. It might make sense if you're a general officer and, you know, you're making $250,000, in which case putting 10% towards your retirement savings would make sense. It could make sense if you've been in for 16 years and have saved $0 for retirement and you need to rapidly catch up over the next 5 to 10 years. But for the average person in uniform who's, you know, somewhere around like 25 or 26 years of age, it's a terrible strategy. You're only saving up money that you can have 40 years from now, and you're depriving yourself of money that you can spend and invest now, which means that you're just delaying your ability to enjoy your hard work and the wealth that you build for decades until, you know, for a lot of us, until we're like too broken to even enjoy it. So, you know, and when it comes back to the real estate topic, which we're on now, we already covered that last week in what some of the conventional wisdom is really not helpful, which is to just go out and use your VA loan. As soon as you can qualify for a loan, use the VA loan and buy a house with 0% down, right? And, you know, the problems that come along with that are that you are now a first-time home buyer, which means other programs that the government has subsidized, mortgage programs specifically like the FHA loan, you're no longer eligible for, right? And so you've cut off an avenue to really cheap, a 3.5% down, you know, option to buy a house. And those FHA loans, you can get them with rehab costs built in. The VA loan also has an option where you can include rehab costs in the loan. Both of these require a lot of paperwork to prove to the banks that if they give you that money and if you do the you know, the rehab that you say you're going to do, the value will be there in the end, of course. But these are really good, you know, programs that you can use. And so, you know, if you just go out and first time you buy a house, you use a VA loan, 0% down, you're going to lose a chance to use the FHA loan. You're going to have zero equity in the house. And so if the value of the home goes down, you could be what's called underwater. And that means you could be forced, if you have to sell it, you might have to come up with cash. And another problem is that when you are using the VA loan and in that kind of strategy, you have a maximum benefit. And that's something that we didn't really explain well enough when we were talking about it. So I'm just kind of taking a minute here to rehash it. And because, you know, one of the things that sets the VA loan apart is you can do it for low down. It is guaranteed by the VA, which means you're also going to get a lower interest rate on a 30-year fixed loan. So it has a lot of advantages, but there's still a catch. And this is one we didn't really explain, which is we did talk about conforming loan limits, right? And that means that a loan for the standard house has to be for a certain amount or less. And it's set that way by the government because the government, you know, partially owned, you know, big, for lack of a better term, companies, but they're not really companies because they're half government, but Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they're buying and selling mortgages on the secondary market. And, you know, the government wants to limit the risk. And so they say for 2025, the conforming loan limit is $806,500. Now, that applies to each and every loan. So if you're, you know, some executive at, you know, a tech company out there in the Bay Area in California, you could go out and you could buy $1 million home, put $200,000 down, take out an $806,500 mortgage, and then next year go out and do it again. And you could keep doing that. The way it applies to the VA loan is that conforming loan limit of $806,500 is also the total amount of VA loan that you can have at any one time. Right. And so if you were to start from the very beginning and go out and use your VA loan and you get a $250,000 loan, and then 3 years later, 4 years later, you PCS, you use it again, you get a $350,000 loan. You know, now you've got $600,000 worth of that VA credit is used up. And then, you know, 3 years later, you go out and you want to, let's say you get out after 8 years and now you move back home and you've got these two properties financed by the VA loan. And they're making you money as rentals, so you're really happy, and you want to buy a home back in your hometown, and you're thinking, I'll use a VA loan. The conforming loan limit is $806,000, so I can go out and buy a house in my hometown, but your eligibility is limited to that, and so you would only have the ability to finance through a VA loan, like $200,000 worth of a house. And so you can see, like, you want to kind of use that VA loan tactically. But how many people around the office are sharing that with you? How many times do you get a, you know, hip pocket class or a kneecap to kneecap discussion with somebody of a higher rank who's trying to make you smart about the VA loan, who's telling you about these other considerations? And so, you know, that's really what the brand's kind of founded on, and is getting to the straight truth and then showing how certain tactics and strategies can really work. And what's the end state, right? The end state obviously is to help everybody in the community become more financially literate, you know, improve your financial education, your financial IQ. But why? You know, it's nobody out here is like saying, hey, I want to have $800,000 in the bank just for the sake of having it. We all have these dreams and these goals for our future life, for our current life, but our future life of things we want. You know, we want to have stability. We want to have comfort. We want to have the freedom to eventually one day stop working, or maybe to stop working for someone else and start working for ourselves, to pursue a hobby or a dream job, you know, move, you know, take over the family business, travel the world, retire early, give your kids the gift of starting their adult lives without debt. You know, there's a lot of different things that we want to do that cost money. And so if you don't really understand how to use it, you're not ever going to really have enough of it to afford your dreams. And so that's really what it comes back to. And the whole purpose of the Military Wealth Coach and our community is to say, go out and find your dreams and your goals, and then come back here and we'll help you figure out how to achieve them, how to afford them, right? And so today what we're going to do by wrapping up the, you know, the sort of the mini series on real estate is we're going to talk about how you make money in real estate. That might seem like a simple answer, like, you know, the typical strategy, the tongue-in-cheek strategy for stocks is like buy low, sell high, like duh, that's how you make money. And with housing, sure, yeah, buy a house at a lower price, sell it at a higher price, you can make money. But the thing with real estate is that there are many other ways. And just like stocks, right? Stocks, there's the price, but then they also could pay dividends. So there are other ways you can make money. But when it comes to real estate, there are multiple ways that you will make money, more ways than you can with a stock investment, for example, or with a bond portfolio. And we want to talk about that today so you can start to think about it as you prepare yourself to go out and shop for and buy your first or your next house. Now, before we get started, I just want to say, again, thanks to everybody who's listening, tuning in every week. It's always really satisfying when you log back into the dashboard and see the downloads are ticking up each week and getting people out there listening. So if you haven't subscribed, we are available on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts, as well as straight on our website. Our website's www.militarywealthcoach.com, or you can subscribe on wherever you get your podcasts. And then also two other things, right? Like one, please give us a rating. The 5-star ratings can help us really bump up the search algorithms and start to reach more people. You know, there's 2 million people in uniform right now between active duty, National Guard, and reserves. And I don't think that we could ever support, you know, a community of 2 million. But, you know, if we could get to like 5 or 10% of that as part of the Military Wealth Coach community, that would be amazing. And taking advantages of the AI and the search algorithms is one way to do it. And then the other way, of course, is to obviously find somebody in your life who is interested in these kind of topics, would benefit from these kind of topics and discussions, and then share with them a link to the podcast or the blog or the website. And so my challenge is find another person this week and get that out there and help us grow the community. And one other thing, of course, that we have to do, because the imaginary lawyer who is my neighbor, but not really, reminds me every week to not get myself in trouble by reminding our audience that the content of this podcast is educational in nature. It's meant to help everybody improve their financial IQ. It's not considered investment, tax, or legal advice. And all investments come with risk. Make your own, do your own research, make your own decisions, and then most importantly, live with the consequences and learn lessons from them. All right, so without further ado, we'll just jump right into the topic for today, which is, you know, how you can make money in real estate transactions. And to get us started, before we actually go into the list, since I've already brought it up once today, which was talking about the importance of kind of ignoring the conventional wisdom or the common strategies that people in the military use and grabbing the VA loan off the shelf right away. It's the FHA loan that I mentioned, the Federal Housing Authority, the FHA 203K loan in particular. So an FHA loan, it can just be a regular one, just like any other loan, 3.5% down for your first home purchase only. Or you can, again, for your first home purchase only, you can put in extra paperwork, do a little bit extra research and prep, and get a FHA 203K loan, which is the Rehabilitation Mortgage Program. And what that does is that gives you money on top of the money for the purchase of the home, gives you money to rehabilitate it. And so why would you do that, and why is that important when it comes to what we're talking about today? Well, short of the actual ways or you know, mechanisms or techniques that real estate can make you money, there's got to be an adage, right? There's always got to be some sort of like adage or cliche or a ditty that you remember. And then when it comes to real estate, it's that you make money on the purchase. Wait, make money on the purchase? What are you talking about? Like, I have to spend the money. I'm buying it. How do I make money on the purchase? I make money when I sell it. You get money when you sell it, but you're not making it when you sell it. You're making it when you buy it. What does that mean? Well, that means, real simply, on the very first level, is don't overpay for a house. Sounds simple, but it can be quite difficult. Now, difficult, you're saying to yourself, like, it's not that difficult. Like, you already told me back in, you know, episode 2 or 3, you know, on this series on real estate, that one of the things I do as I'm going through the process from contract to close is I have an appraiser come in, and the appraiser says, this is how much this house is worth compared to other houses in the area. And then I have the chance to, you know, renegotiate the sales price, or maybe I find out I'm getting a good deal, or maybe I just back out of the contract and get my money back because there's no way I can get a loan for this house. You know, if it's, I'm under contract for $250,000 and the appraiser comes back and says $220,000, that means I'm agreeing to overpay $30,000. So it's bad. Now, if I'm super desperate, or if I think the appraiser's just totally full of it, maybe I go forward, but the bank's only going to lend me $220,000 or up to 80% of $220,000. So I have to come out with extra cash, you know, up with extra cash out of my pocket. A lot of people will try to jump through these hoops in order to buy the house that they want. But when you have to jump through hoops, when you have to squeeze extra dollars, when you have to like find ways around it, those are all warning signs that you're overpaying for a property. So that sort of adage, it really holds true. Like, you make money when you buy. Your goal should be to identify deals. And the great thing about the internet and companies like Zillow is you can basically get free information and find all this stuff out for yourself and make a decision. So you can do some research, compare. You might be looking at a house that's listed for $349,000 and it's 2,600 square feet. And you're looking around and you see that everything else in the 2,600 square foot range is actually being priced at like $325,000. Maybe they're all the same. Maybe they're all 5-bed, 3-bath with a detached garage in the yard. You know, they all look and sound very similar. You are already doing your own comp analysis, comparables, market comparables, realizing like that house is probably overpriced. Well, why do people buy it? Well, they buy it because there might be new appliances, new paint, new floors, new countertops. there might be some bonus room. There might be, you know, a really deluxe walk-in shower or nice cabinetry or closets, all of which, you know, maybe cost $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 to do. And these people want, you know, an extra $25,000 on top for the sales price. So as you learn and as you get smart, you'll and you do the research, like we said, you should be starting your own homework, if at all possible, 6 months before you plan to actually buy, which is not, you know, that's not unheard of in the military, because we'll typically get orders somewhere around 6 to 9, maybe 12 months out from our PCS. So we have an idea where we're going. We can look up our BAH rates. We can figure out what we can afford, and we can start researching. It's quite easy to do. We don't even need an agent. So, you know, that's one of the main things that you have to look out for. And hopefully we never go back to it, but during the buying frenzy of the post-COVID outbreak, during the sort of the COVID, wasn't even really a COVID recession. It was just sort of like a period of fiscal and financial and economic uncertainty. But for anybody who was in the game or even just paying attention, you know, interest rates got dropped basically to zero. Mortgages were super cheap. It was a buying frenzy. And what did everybody do? Everybody was so desperate to get that beautiful new or beautiful, you know, refinished, refurbished home that they were waiving contingencies. They're saying, you know what, I'm not going to use an appraiser. I will just agree to this contract price, or I will waive my appraisal clause because the bank still needs the appraisal so that they can figure out how much they'll lend me. But I'm going to waive my escape clause. So even if it appraises higher than I can afford, I'm still going to buy it. Or maybe they'd waive their inspection clause. All of these are dangerous things. And you could see it happening time and time again throughout COVID, was young couples, young families, young individuals, first-time home buyers were going out there finding a beautiful house, bidding like $450,000 just to win the house. And then the appraisal was coming back for like 400 or 420. And they had to come up with an extra 30, 50K out of pocket, or else they were going to lose their earnest money. So you make your money on the purchase. You don't want to waive your contingencies. You want to hold on to them. And you want to do your own research so you don't hopefully get into a contract for an overpriced property in the first place. Now, the next bit is, or related to that, is again using this FHA 203K loan, which allows you to get money to rehab. And so, you know, I just kind of wanted to go with a practical example here. And you'll have to bear with me because it's a little bit slow to do these online calculators. And I should have just probably done it in three separate windows, but I didn't. But I decided, you know what, I'm going to go to Waco, Texas. I'm going to pretend I'm back in uniform, but I'm in the Army now. And I said, well, let's play with this. Let's not, you know, I was an officer, so don't do the officer thing. Let's look at some other levels of affordability. And so I said, well, let's say I'm married E7 with kids. I get PCS down there to Waco, and my BAH is going to be $2,046. So do I have to use all that for housing? No, absolutely not. It's just an entitlement. It's cash I'm going to get no matter what. I could live in a, you know, in a van that I pay a $300 sewer hookup for at the local RV park, and I'll still get my $2,100. But let's just say that I'm committed to using it. You know, I want to get a bigger house because I've got two kids and a wife, and, you know, she works at home, and I'm not assuming that, you know, there's only for, you know, men in uniform. I'm just talking as myself, like I'm role playing here. And so I'm going to take a look at if I wanted to do like a zero down just for the heck of it, even though I already said like it's not optimal, but a zero down VA loan. Now, the first step whenever you're doing this is not to figure out how much you can qualify for based on your income and your wife's income, because she works from home and has some cool, you know, side hustles, and your BAH all added it and together, you probably could qualify for, you know, enough to buy like a $450,000 home. That monthly payment on that mortgage, including taxes and insurance, is looking to be about $3,200. So if you don't have any other debts, we're just going to assume you could afford it based on, you know, your household income. And, you know, then we go over to Zillow, and lo and behold, we found this $450,000 house. It's in the middle of town. Great location. 2,800 square feet, 4 beds, 3 baths. It's perfect, right? You have your bedroom. Each kid gets their own bedroom. There's a fourth bedroom as a home office. 3 bathrooms. So in the morning, there's no chaos and tripping over each other. And it's got a pool, right? So now everybody's super stoked because you're in Texas in the summer and you've got a pool in the backyard. And that pool is adding quite a bit to the sales price. And if you went straight away to an agent or a loan officer, they tell you you could afford it. But what's the actual value of this property? Well, it's a little bit outdated. It needs some work. It's got some new appliances, but it's also got some old appliances and old flooring. And, you know, it's big lot, but it's not a perfect house. So you keep shopping. And now you stumble upon this brand new build out in the north of the airport. It's out in a new subdivision. It's 4 bed, 3 bath, 2,600 square feet. Oh, wow. Same number of beds, so you still get the same living space, same number of baths, so you're still not knife fighting in the mornings when everybody's trying to get ready for school and work. 2,600 square feet, you know, it doesn't have a pool, but it's only $350,000. Now, that would be a monthly mortgage payment of about $2,500. You'd save $650, $700 a month by spending $100,000 less. But this is still, for $350,000, you're getting a brand new home. You're paying maximum price and maximum value. It is a nice home. It doesn't need any work. But you think, well, you know, I'm a handy. You know, I can do a lot of stuff. My mom taught me how to do, you know, rehang cabinets and do renovations because she was a fix and flipper when I was a kid, and that was her side hustle, which we didn't call side hustles back in the day. And you remember that she said, hey, you can put a little bit of elbow grease in there and, you know, make a place that's kind of run down, make it your own and make it perfect. And then you remember on the Surface and Wealth podcast, that adage of like, you make money on the purchase. So you keep looking. And you end up right back downtown, right next to Saley Park, only about 3 blocks down from that massive 4-3 with the pool for $450,000, and you find this 4-3, 2,800 square feet for only $240,000, just over half the price. And at that, you're looking at a mortgage payment of only about $1,700. Each month, it's going to be about $1,500 cheaper. And this house, why is it cheap? Why is it listed so cheaply? Well, it needs some landscaping. It needs some exterior work, and it needs work inside. It's got some, you know, really beautiful parts of the house that have been updated and finished, and then it's got some like parts that need a lot of work, like the kitchen, one of the bathrooms, a hallway, another bathroom. But overall, yeah, and that, you know, the deck, the exterior. When you look at it and you find it on Zillow, it doesn't look that nice. It doesn't look shiny and new. It doesn't have all the stainless appliances. It doesn't have the perfectly manicured lawn and the white picket fence. But you could save over $200,000 on this. And you know already that a 4-3 with 2,800 square feet in this market, if it is updated, is going to sell for at least $350,000. You know, this is something that, again, this is how you can make money on the purchase. Is if you commit to it over the next 3 years while you're there in Waco between you and your wife and maybe the occasional, you know, contractor you bring in to help out with some other things like refinishing the cabinets for you or doing the countertops or flooring's easy, painting's easy. You can do all that kind of stuff. You can do landscaping. You could put in, you know, $30,000 or $40,000 into this house over 2 or 3 years and turn around and sell it for like $375,000 or $400,000. And you end up making a couple $100,000 on the deal, right? So that's sort of the overall approach that you got to take when you go out and you're buying a home is don't get distracted by the shiny stuff. Don't go chasing after things that the bank tells you afford. Set your budget, come up with an economical monthly payment that you want to pay, even if you could afford to pay more, and then go find a house that is underpriced or needs some updating and is intentionally priced on the cheap, and then commit yourself to doing some work over the next couple of years. And here's the thing, you're not even trying to sell it in 2 or 3 years. Once you move out, you're going to need to really seriously consider keeping it as a rental for cash flow. And so you don't even have to have it perfect in 2 or 3 years. You could do nothing for 2 or 3 years. Then when you PCS, bring in a contractor, give them 2 months to rehab a bunch of stuff and then rent it out. And then in 3 or 4 years after that, then go and sell it for even more. And so that's sort of how the strategy would play out. And then within that, now we can look at the specific ways that this strategy or any other real estate purchase is going to make you money. Now, the traditional ways that you think about it, again, we already said, like, okay, buy low, sell high, you make profit on the sale. And yes, that's true. Now, since we're also talking about real estate as an investment, something you keep after you move out, or you even purchase solely to be a rental, then obviously rental income is another way that you are going to make money. And one of the things that when we got started in real estate, you know, we read all the books, we read about the rules, and there's a thing, you know, called like the 1% rule. And then there's some other guidelines. And what they try to do is give you a guideline of how much to spend for a property based on the rent that you're going to get, and then only buy it if you're going to get that much rent. Like the 1% rule, like, are you going to get, you know, $2,000 rent on a single family home you buy for $200,000? Well, back in the day, yeah, maybe, but probably not anymore. Now, especially that we're looking at the average, you know, home price in America being $420,000. That's much more than the average rent anywhere. And even the average starter home in most places in America, which is 3-bed, 2-bath, and 1,200 square foot, that average price in America is still over $360,000. And there's not a lot of places you're going to get $3,600 a month in rent on that. Some of the other guidance would be trying to look at the cash flow, right? Trying to make sure you're making at least $100 a month, like positive cash flow. Well, that still can be kind of difficult, especially if you're, you know, buying this traditional starter home. And we're saying that's, what, $367,000. And so the mortgage, you know, the mortgage payment on that is probably going to be like $2,700, right? So again, there's not a lot of markets where you're going to be able to get $2,700, $2,800 in rent. Does that mean that you should not buy a house? Well, it may not be a good business decision to buy a house that's going to cost you $1,700 a month, but is only going to bring in $1,700 in rent, or you break even, or maybe even you lose like a couple $100 over the course of the year because you have to replace some air filters and lights and things like that. But rent doesn't stay static. It doesn't stay the same year after year. And rents on average will go up, depending on the market, 3 to 5% per year. And this rent growth is a third way that you can make money. Some people might say like it's part of rent. We tend to say that rent growth is a third way that you can make money, because that means as your mortgage payment stays the same year after year after year, you're raising the rent $50, $75, $100. And after 2 or 3 years, you're still paying $1,700 a month on the mortgage, but now you're getting $2,000 in rent. Or maybe, you know, In a more typical case, you buy this house and you know that the average rents in the area are like $1,500, your mortgage payment's $1,700, but you're living in it Well, after 3 or 4 years, when you PCS to a new duty station, there's a good chance that those rents will have caught up, and especially in a military community, because every year our BAH is being increased by Congress, and, well, not by Congress, actually just, it's just indexed to essentially cost of living adjustments, and so you're going to get 3 or 4 or 5% built-in rent raises in a military community every year because people are getting more in BAH, which means that you sort of have this like double insurance when it comes to making money through rental income as a real estate investor in the military, in a military community, is you have a constant supply of renters who are getting and a tax-free entitlement from Uncle Sam, so they always are going to have the budget to pay the rent. And Uncle Sam is increasing that budget every year, 3 or 4 or 5%, which means they're automatically giving you that built-in increase in rent each year. You don't have to guess, like if you're in a civilian marketplace and the major factory shuts down, or, you know, a computer software engineering company decides to move from Pennsylvania down to Alabama, and now rents are going down, down, down because everybody's moving away. You know, you're in a military community, so there's constant supply of renters, there's a constant budget, and that budget is constantly going up. So the ways that you make money by owning rental properties through rent and rent growth, those first two ways, are actually even stronger and more locked in when you're in the military. You know, we already covered appreciation, which is the value of the house going up. Tied to that are two things called equity and amortization. And that kind of like fits into one piece. And what do I mean by that? So we already talked about with the rent, you're receiving rental income is growing while your mortgage payment stays the same. So you got two ways there. When it comes to the actual property itself, the value of the property, the value's going up. So you're making money. You might buy it at $250,000 in the US, the average rate of increase in the value of real estate, residential real estate, is about 3.5% per year. So you own this house for, you know, we'll just say 6 years, and now this house is worth about $300,000. So you've made $50,000 on the house. However, at the same time, you have, and that's equity, right? You're building equity. You've because you're not actually getting the cash in your pocket. It's just the difference between how much the house is worth and like how much you had in it, or like how much you owe, right? So equity is growing. But along with that is amortization, or sometimes called loan pay down. And what that is every month the amount you owe is going down because you're making that mortgage payment. And here's the beautiful thing about owning rental real estate is your tenants are paying it. So yeah, sure, you lived in the house for the first 3 years, but now that you're renting it out, the rent your tenants are paying you is not just maybe putting some cash in your pocket, but it's actually paying down the balance of your loan, which is helping you do what's called equity capture. Here's an example. Again, you bought a $250,000 house. Let's say you used the FHA loan because you're smart. So you had to put, what's that, like $10,000 down. So you owed $240,000 on a $250,000 house. You lived in it for 3 years. By the time you move out, you still owe $225,000 on the mortgage, and that house is worth $275,000. You move some tenants in and you rent it out to them for the next 5 years. Or let's say 4 years. The next 4 years. They pay that the rent, and the rent pays down your mortgage, and now you only owe $200,000 on the mortgage, but your house is now worth $300,000. So here you are 6 or 7 years later, and because of the appreciation as well as the amortization or mortgage pay down from the tenants, that $10,000 down payment that you needed using your FHA loan to buy this house, you now have $100,000 of equity or potential profit in this house. The value of the house goes up, the value of the loan goes down. So you're making money in two directions. How does that compare to if you're just buying, you know, mutual funds? Well, the money that you use, the amount that you buy an investment for, is called your basis. If you buy a mutual fund for $100 and it goes up to $150, you still had to pay the same basis. It's still $100 was your cost to get in. It doesn't go down. It's not like there's some sort of magic fairy that's like sprinkling cash on your original investment to make it go down so that you can get more equity out. You're only going to get the difference between what you paid, which is 100, and what you sell it at 150. Real estate has this extra dimension in which the value goes down, and that allows you to make more money when you finally sell. So we've got, you know, we've got those kind of like four core ways, which are the value goes up, the mortgage balance goes down, you get rental income, and rents go up over time. So when you piece it together, it's really useful to kind of like look at the numbers and realize that something that might be break even right now, especially an investment, a real estate purchase in a military community, has got built-in pressures to make the value go up over time. As, you know, especially as you know, different businesses come in to serve different needs in the community, and the civilian population grows, and you know, you're going to have the demand for more housing, so that'll push up prices. And one of the things that we're seeing, you know, in the United States is, it's really quite fascinating, is in 2024, the same number of single-family homes were built in the United States in 2024 as were built in the year 1954, even though our population has doubled. Right? Back then, there were like 170 million Americans, 160. Now there's like 330, 340 million Americans, maybe more. And we're still building the same number of houses every year. And so what that does is, obviously, it means that demand from more people is going to keep going up, but the supply is not keeping up. And that's one of the big reasons why home prices have gone up so quickly over the last few years. It's not like a bubble. It's not a speculation back like in, you know, 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, when there were really bad, you know, lending practices and really, you know, everybody was kind of cheating the system. A lot of what we're seeing today is home prices are going up because our population's going up and the supply of housing is not going up with it. Well, that should tell you right now, there's no better time to invest in real estate than now, because it's highly unlikely that prices are going to come down again in our lifetime. All right, but so anyway, you know, you go out and you might find a break-even deal, but you have to be able to understand these different dimensions in which you can make money on your investment over time. And, you know, the average American homeowner who just buys their home and lives in it is selling a home every 12, 13 years, whereas the average real estate investor typically is selling every 6 to 8 years. So that's kind of your investment horizon. And if you can forecast out 6 to 8 years and say, well, my mortgage is still going to be the same. It's going to be $1,700 in 6 years from now, but at 5% growth in rent, I'm going to be collecting $2,100, $2,200 a month in rent 6 years from now. And, you know, the tenants are going to be paying down my mortgage. Meanwhile, the value is going up at 3.5% to 4% per year. That's going to result in something like a guaranteed, you know, 10 to 12% rate of return per year over those 6-7 years. You're not going to get that if you only look at one dimension. If you only look at, is this investment going to, you know, satisfy the 1% rule? Is this investment going to net me at least $100 in rental income? If that's the only thing you're looking at, you're going to pass on a lot of really good deals, or potentially really good deals that don't look good now, but in 5 years are going to be fantastic. The same is true if you're only looking at the appreciation of 3.5%, you could be really tempted to take that $20,000 you saved from your last deployment and just pop it into your brokerage account and buy a bunch of, you know, NVIDIA stock. You're like, well, NVIDIA has been going up at like 40% per year. Even if it slows down and only grows at 10%, that's still going to trounce the 3.5% in appreciation I get on my real estate. Well, again, you've got the 3.5% in the increase, average increase in the value of the property. You've got 5% average annual increase in rent. That's 8.5% right there. Now, we've mentioned it earlier in this series, and I bring it up again because that's, again, not fully understanding, and this is another way that you make money on real estate, and that's through the use of leverage. When you go out and you buy a house, the house itself is going to grow 3.5% per year, but you don't have to pay cash for the house. We can take a simple example using a $100,000 house. If it goes up to 3.5% in 1 year, and now it's worth $103,500, everybody out there, and you know, I have friends, really, really dear friends and trusted friends who to this day are highly skeptical of real estate and say, just invest in the stock market. Real estate grows too slowly. The return on investment's too low. It's only 3.5%. And you try to explain to them, okay, yeah, that house went from 100 to 103.5. But as an investment, if I purchased that house with 20% down, I spent $20,000 and I gained $3,500 on that $20,000. Which means I actually got a 17.5% return on investment, because $3,500 in 1 year is 17.5% of $20,000. Well, what if I listen to the Service and Wealth podcast and realize that it's an even smarter idea to qualify for less than 20% down and use like 10% down with a conventional loan and pay the primary mortgage insurance, the PMI? So now I put 10% down. I put $10,000 down on this $100,000 house, and it grew $3,500. That's a 35% return on investment in 1 year. What if I only did a FHA loan, because this is my first house, and I only had to put 3.5% down? That's $3,500 down to buy a $100,000 house that then grew in value by $3,500 in that first year. I got all my money back. That's 100% return on investment. And then you add on top of that, you know, any cash flow. That's just gravy. This is, you know, this is my opinion and my strategy based on my experience. Buying for the equity and that increase in value using leverage and having tenants pay down your mortgage. So you're doing the amortization, appreciation, equity play. That will make you tens, if not hundreds of times more money than whatever profit you get on your rental income. And so we don't even try to do the 1% rule or the net cash flow test anymore. We look at, is this property in a great neighborhood? Is it going to appreciate in value? Because if I make $100 a month in rent and that I'm counting on that over the next 3 years, that's $3,600 in profit over 3 years. Like, what does that buy you? That pays for your Hulu subscription and your Spotify, right? Like, that's all it pays for. And that might pass the 1% rule. It might be a cash flowing property, but it doesn't buy me much. On the flip side, maybe I buy a property, a rental property, and I'm losing $100 a month, and I lose $3,600 over the next 3 years in rent. But that property appreciates because it's in a great neighborhood and great community with constant demand and increasing demand. And I sell it and I make $50,000, right? So the equity play is a much bigger play. And again, that's my opinion. That's our strategy. You don't have to believe me. You can choose to follow whatever strategy you want. I'm happy to debate anybody on it, but that's how we look at it. Now there's a couple final ways that you make money in real estate. And the reason why we put these at the end is because they should not be your deciding factors, right? So We've got equity appreciation. We've got amortization or mortgage pay down. We've got rental income and we've got rental growth. And then a fifth one is tax benefits. And that's what's really awesome is when you're living in your house, all of those expenses are your expenses. But when you turn that house into a place of business or an actual investment property or rental, now you get to play by a whole new set of rules from the tax code. And what are those? Well, property taxes become deductible. Mortgage interest becomes deductible and above and beyond your standard deduction. You know, if you're married and you're taking the standard deduction, you would have to pay a whole heck of a lot of mortgage interest to make it worth your while to deduct it. But once you have that as a rental property, you get to deduct the mortgage interest. You know, you get to deduct the cost of insurance. You get to deduct travel, repairs, right? Think about that. When you're living in the house, if the water heater goes out and you got to spend $500 to fix it, it's $500 out of your paycheck after taxes, right? And so if you are, you know, paying 20% income tax, you had to earn $600, pay 20%. Now with the $500, you know, left over, now you got to fix the water heater. Well, if it's a rental property and the water heater breaks, that $500 expense is now a business expense. It's a tax deduction. And it can help offset any profits, or it can turn into a loss. And you can take passive losses, which can help reduce capital gains from other passive activities. So you have this great tax and tax deduction offsets that are written in the IRS code. And why is that? Well, because the U.S. government really only cares about a few things. It wants to make sure that people can eat. It wants to make sure that people have houses, that they have jobs, that they have energy so that they can turn on the lights and they can watch TV and consume stuff, and they have transportation, right? And so within our tax code, the biggest benefits are handed out to people who provide jobs, food, energy, transportation, and housing. And when you become a real estate investor, you're providing housing, which means you get to now start playing by a different set of rules and making those, taking those tax advantages and making money. Now, within that, there's another part of it that you can start doing when you turn your property into a rental, and that's called depreciation. When you're living in that house, nobody cares. But within the tax code, it says that residential real estate, on average, after over 27.5 years, will have to be totally rebuilt and replaced. Now, if you've ever been over to Grandma and Grandpa's house, which is built in 1939 and hasn't been updated in 50 years, you know that that's like in reality not the truth, but that's what the tax code says. And so what that means is as a rental property, you can, and this is oversimplification, but you can take that the value of the property, the purchase price, divide it by 27.5, and then each year you can take an additional deduction for the value that is quote-unquote depreciated or the amount it wears away. So if you have a $300,000 house that you're renting out to folks, you can deduct about like $10,000 a year. Now, if you were on the verge of making a profit because you had good margins and you were collecting $2,000 in rent, paying a $1,500 mortgage, $500 in profit per month on your rent, that's $6,000 a year, that depreciation can offset it. Right. And so now when you'd file your taxes, instead of saying, hey, Uncle Sam, I made $6,000 profit, you know, in rent from this rental property I have. And Uncle Sam's like, oh, that's great. We're going to tax you 20%. Give us $1,200. You can use the depreciation, offset it and say, actually, hey, look, I lost some money. And they're like, oh, that's so sad. We're not going to tax you now. And part of that is a passive loss carryover that you can carry over to next year. Just in case you make money next year, then you can subtract the carryover and again, avoid paying taxes on your rental income. Whew. All right. So those are the core ways you make money. And when you add it all together, you should never be below a 20% ROI with your real estate investments. You may not get it the first year, but that ROI is going to go up every year because your rents are going to go up. because the values of the property are going to go up, because the tax deductions you can take are always going to be there. The way that loans are amortized is when you first start paying them, they're mostly interest, but over time they become more and more principal, which means each year that passes, you know, if you just go to like bank rate and you put in your mortgage information and then you look at the amortization table, you can see each year how much you're paying out in principal and interest. In that first year, you might be paying $5,000 in principal and $15,000 in interest. But by the fifth or sixth year, it might be like $10,000 and $10,000. What does that mean? Well, that means your equity capture from your tenants paying off the mortgage is going to be going faster and faster and faster each year. So it's not a flat return on investment. It goes up. It's almost exponential, right? And that's not something that you're going to get in any other asset class or investment. Now, we want to wrap this up with one final thought on why investing in real estate while you're in the military is the optimal strategy, not only for you, but for any real estate investor. Like if you're a real estate investor and you're looking at people who are in the military, you are just like so envious, right? And you may not think it, right? Because you're in the military and you're like, well, I only get paid $50,000 a year and I get another $25,000 in BAH and that's nothing. And okay, yeah, so I get free healthcare and free dental and free vision, and that saves us as a family, that saves us $25,000 a year or so. Yeah, my base pay is 50, but I'm actually getting $100,000 in compensation. Okay, it's not so bad. Well, the other thing that you've got to realize is that your budget that you have from Uncle Sam to go out and do whatever you want comes from that BAH, which is tax-free. $25,000 in BAH is saving you, on average, probably about $3,500 to $4,000 a year in taxes because it's not taxable. It keeps you at a lower tax bracket. It could be saving you even more. It could be saving you $5,000 or more in taxes per year. And then you get to invest that tax-free money in real estate. And then when you sell the real estate, you make profit. It's almost like when you use your BAH to invest in real estate, it's almost like doing a mega backdoor Roth. And that's something we haven't gotten into too much, but that's basically, you know, if you're in the military, when you're here in the States, you would, instead of making Roth TSP contributions, you would make traditional TSP contributions, because then you could deduct those contributions and not pay taxes on that money now. And then when you're deployed to a combat zone tax exclusion area where you're not going to be taxed on any of your monies that year, you do a mega backdoor Roth conversion, changing all that traditional money into Roth money. You're in a tax-free zone, so like you could possibly do it tax-free, which means you paid no taxes on the money going in, and then you're going to get all these profits on the back end in your retirement account tax-free. When you get BAH tax-free money, you can put that into your real estate investments. Your money's going to go farther. You can buy more. You're saving on taxes. And then down the line, when you sell, there's two different ways that you can sell and avoid paying taxes on real estate. One is the 121C rule, which says so long as you've lived in that house as your primary residence, 24 months out of the last 5 years, it counts as a primary residence. And when you sell it, you can pay zero tax on up to $250,000 in profit if you're single, or $500,000 if you're married. You know, that should be setting off some like bells and whistles in your brain, right? With the PCS cycle in the military, as you buy a house, you live in it for 3 years, then you rent it out for 3 years, and then you sell it, and you can make like $100,000 tax-free, right? And you did it all with tax-free money going in with BAH. The other way is a 1031 exchange, which is a different route entirely. We don't have time for it today. But the point is that, well, everybody's going to talk about these sort of like five traditional ways that you make money in real estate, and that makes it a superior investment for you. I'm telling you, because you're in the military and you get tax-free income precisely to go out and buy housing, don't waste it away on rent. Don't waste it away on burritos and beer and PlayStation 5. Use that money, invest it, in real estate that you're going to come back in the future. You're going to take advantage of at least six different ways to make money. And by the time you get out of uniform, or even if you get out after 4, 5, or 6 years, by the time you're 40 or 50 years old, you'll be a multimillionaire just because you're using leverage and tax-free income to go buy real estate. And then you get other people's money to pay the rent, pay your profits, pay your taxes, pay your insurance, pay off the mortgage. And then you get to sell and you can take advantage of tax law to get capital gains tax-free profit. All right. I think this is a good place to wrap up this week. The last few weeks we've gone over the hour mark. I think we're right around the hour mark today. It's hard to tell because I don't know how many bars are equal to 1 hour on GarageBand. But this basically wraps up our planned real estate episode miniseries. We've had seven. We've taken you all the way from understanding the very basics, which is like buying real estate is all about the ownership of the land beneath, you know, and what's on the deed. And when you buy it, it's yours. It doesn't matter if there's a mortgage on it from the bank. You own it. We talked about how what people pay the most money for and what the real focus is what's been built on the land, the house itself. And that's what you need the mortgage to afford. Then you got to inspect it. You got to do an ownership and encumbrance report to make sure that there's nobody who can come take it from you. You want to do an appraisal to find out the value's correct. You're going to put together a team. You're going to take control of this whole process and of your money. You're not just going to go out and grab the first agent off of Zillow and then have them screw you over because they don't know how to deal with a VA loan. They don't have a VA appraiser. The loan officer they hook you up with is lazy. You know, like you're going to ask these questions and you can head over to the blog because we've put out blog posts that have those questions for you to ask the loan officers and the title officers and the real estate agents to make sure that they are looking out for you and that they know what they're doing. We talked about the process that it takes from your sort of own phasing where like 6 months out to moving to a new place, you're going to start researching and getting smart. And then you're going to figure out like the value and like know how much you want to spend and not just let the bank tell you how much you can afford, but tell them how much you want to spend and buy a house based on that. We talked about the things that have to happen in between getting under contract when you make an offer all the way out to close and why it takes a month and why if you're not managing it and keeping tabs on it, reminding your agent, reminding the loan officer, hey, this should be due this week, this should be due on Tuesday, it can take you 40, 45 days, right? And now you're out of pocket in a hotel because you're, oh man, I don't even remember the acronyms right now, but your entitlements when you PCS for housing have run out, you know? And then we talked about why mortgages are special. We talked about the VA loan. And then last week we talked about this sort of campaign plan and we're going to put that, we haven't put that out on the blog yet, but that'll be coming out this week, on the blog. It's just showing how like along a timeline where you want to mix together different kinds of loan products. Just because you're in the military and you can have the VA loan doesn't mean you should only use a VA loan. It doesn't even mean you should prioritize a VA loan. The VA loan is like a tactical nuke that you want to pull out when it makes sense. And, you know, we covered the cases in which that it does make sense, in which you should be using it. And we covered the cases in which you would want to go with conventional financing. You know, we even talked about like conventional loan doesn't mean 20% down. And in fact, it's almost always a better deal to try to put 5 or 10 or 15% down, whatever you can qualify for with the bank, and pay the PMI because the PMI is going to be less than what you would be paying with that additional down payment over, oftentimes it would take over 20 years to make up the difference. You know, and then, so then this week we finished up just talking about the different ways you can make money and hopefully you had your ink stick and your Write in the Rain notebook out so that you were taking notes and you're already heading over to Zillow to start looking at properties and practicing these different techniques and teaching yourself how to buy real estate. So that's going to wrap it up. We'll be back next week with more. Haven't decided what it's going to be about. So as always, you can hit us up on social media. Most of our accounts are MWC112358, whether it's Facebook or Instagram. We're not really doing TikTok right now. You can find us on LinkedIn. You can search for Military Wealth Coach or you can search for me, Ted Ehlert, and send us a DM with episode ideas or suggestions. And if there's anybody out there who wants to come on and do a Q&A session or just have like a debate on anything we've talked about or anything we haven't talked about, that's really what I'm keen to do next. And so we've got an open invitation for anybody out there in the community who wants to jump on, and we'll do a live episode. Well, it'll be live to us, but then we'll record it and then we'll post it. And I think it'd be a lot of fun. So thanks again for listening this week. Thanks again for listening every week. And until next time, stay financially fit and mission ready.